So my name is Emily Zimmerman, but two important team members from my team are here in the audience, Sarah Cook and Amber Haley. So I wanted to mention them as well. I have no relationships to disclose. We already talked a bunch about what these methods are about in terms of engaging patients and stakeholders in coming up with and prioritizing the questions that are important to them. And of course, that is a preliminary stage in the whole process of patient-centered outcomes research. And so I'll skip some of this. We have developed a new method for engaging stakeholders, including patients, clinicians, funders, policymakers, whoever you want to define as a stakeholder for your purposes, in developing research questions and prioritizing them. And so for this project, our intermediate aims were actually to conduct some demonstrations of how this methodology would look as it was implemented in two different communities. And by doing this demonstration, we hope to show that the SEED method for developing research questions and prioritizing them is a method that could be replicable and scalable so for example, for this project, we set out to do two demonstrations that would take 9 months in each site. But we're hoping that this will be a scalable method so that communities that had more time and could do this at a more leisurely pace would be able to do that. And those places that needed to do a quicker process could take components of the methodology and maybe do a quicker project. We also are doing an evaluation of this method, and we'll go into that in a little bit of detail. And finally, one of our intermediate aims is to have a toolkit that we can disseminate so that other researchers can use this methodology in the future. So like I said, we have two demonstration sites. One of them is in Richmond, Virginia, which is an urban area. And we, at Virginia Commonwealth University, have been working with local residents in Richmond, Virginia, in community-based participatory research for a number of years. And they worked with us to develop a health topic that they thought would be important to study in this demonstration. And so they developed the idea of looking at diet compliance for hypertension and diabetes. We also worked with our practice-based research network, who also endorsed that idea as a good topic for the area. And then we have a second demonstration site in Martinsville, which is a rural area. And based on the work that has been coming out of those rural areas in Virginia, they chose to develop a focus on respiratory cancer outcomes. In our long-term aims, again, is to provide a research methodology, a framework that future researchers can use to develop. One of the components of the model is to develop causal models so that our stakeholders, our patients, can understand all of the determinants that might go into the specific health outcome, and then have them work together to collaboratively generate the research questions. So this is a sort of a complex project. Again, the demonstrations are set to take place over 9 months, and we have three levels of stakeholder engagement throughout this process. So we have, first and foremost, a participatory research team. So in Richmond, this is our community-based participatory research team that we've been working with for a couple of years, and it's their job to collaboratively lead this project. So from start to finish, they're making decisions all throughout. So as a principal investigator, I'm not on the research team because I'm not a member of the community-based participatory research team. I used to be, actually, but at this point in time, I'm not. And the point is that this participatory team can take the reins throughout this project. We have named our second group of stakeholders our topic groups, and these are folks who are brought together for their expertise in the topic matter. And so our topic groups can be any type of stakeholder. They can be patients, they can be certain specific types of patients, they can be clinicians, service providers, policymakers, whoever the research team chooses and prioritizes throughout this process. For the demonstration sites, we've decided that each one will have exactly three topic groups, and they'll each be organized by type. And our third type of participants is what we call our SCAN participants, and these are folks who get the chance to participate through focus groups and interviews. So they have a brief participation, but this allows us to spread out a little bit further into getting more ideas and hearing from more folks who are affected by the health topic. So just to summarize that, our three levels of engagement. Number one is our research team, so that's a collaborative process. Number two is our topic groups, so that's a participatory process. And number three is our SCAN participants, so that's a consultative process. So again, this whole method is really, it's really about engagement. It's really about leading the project, bringing expertise to the project, and contributing ideas, perspectives to the project. Sarah Cook made this lovely diagram to show how it all fits together. So this is a vision for our Richmond site, and you can see that over on the in the corner we have our research staff and faculty, and they are working together with everybody in the blue box. Engaging Richmond is our CBPR team, that's the research team leading the project. Again, we have our topic groups and our SCAN participants. These are our folks who are self-identified with diabetes or hypertension, or our service providers, and they're all kind of reflecting the community perspective as well. Here's kind of an overview of the whole process. So our first step is to identify and engage. Who are our stakeholders, and how are they going to be involved throughout the process? The second part is to consult. Again, we bring in those focus groups and interviews. We want to get a wide variety of perspectives. How are people impacted? What are their ideas? The next step is to conceptualize. Again, I'll get a little bit more into how do we develop these causal models with our topic groups. Once they've had that opportunity, we work with them to develop questions, generate questions, and then we work with them to prioritize those questions. And finally, ultimately, the product is a stakeholder-driven research agenda that has to be disseminated to be useful, right? So how can we get that out there to funders, potential researchers, advocacy organizations, anybody who makes decisions about what should be researched or implements research? We want to reach them and say, this is what patients, this is what service providers think would be really great ideas for research topics. This is kind of complicated, but it again summarizes our process. So you can see the 9-month process, each of those steps divided out, and our three components, the research team, the topic groups, and the SCAN participants. So what does our research team actually do over the course of this project? Well, the first thing was they decided on the topic, right? So in Richmond, they decided diet compliance for diabetes and hypertension. In Martinsville, they decided on cancer, lung cancer outcomes. They identify the topic groups. That is, they go through a process of looking at who in their community is affected by the health problem. How are they impacted? Who's disproportionately impacted? Who's being left out of the process? They ask a whole lot of questions about the demographics and the needs of the community in order to say, who are we going to invite to be our experts and participate in this project? And once they've decided that, they go out and recruit those folks. They also go out and they can work with the topic groups, and they go out and they do the focus groups and the interviews with other people in the community. And again, they identify who are those people that we're going to work with in the community. They work together to do the logistics and planning for all of the meetings that go on throughout this process. After the topic groups do their conceptual models, they review and edit those. After the topic groups create their questions, they review those and finalize those, and finally they work on the dissemination plan. This is just an example of one of the tools that we use throughout the process. We have lots and lots of tools. This is a matrix that we've developed. It's really just the top portion to help them identify who are the stakeholders in the community that they're going to invite to be part of these topic groups. So again, they can develop the criteria along the top. So these are just examples. Criteria one, they could identify people based on their risk level in the community, who's at risk for this disease. Criteria two was presence in the study area. Who in this community has a high prevalence rate for this disease? And Criteria three was who's vulnerable in this community. Again, the question, who's being left out? And then they just go through a whole list, and again, this is just the top, but they look at things like sex, sexual orientation, age, comorbid conditions, anything that they think is important, and they start kind of rating out all of those different groups so that they can finally decide which ones they're going to focus on for their topic groups. So again, this is kind of summarizing all the levels of engagement. This is our Richmond demonstration site. On our research team, we had 2 VCU faculty and staff members, and we had 11 community members. So these were members of the local urban community. They did not have past research experience. A few of them had been in our CBPR team for quite a while, so they had that experience. But prior to that, they hadn't had any training. And some of them were fresh out of the community, wanting to participate and starting anew. In our topic groups, they selected 3 different groups. The first 2 were patient groups. So the first patient group had 8 seniors with diabetes or hypertension, and also obesity or cardiovascular disease. So they were self-identified to fit into this group. We didn't collect any health information from anybody. Our second patient group was adults with diabetes or hypertension and one or other of these other characteristics. So no regular place for care, uninsured, veterans, people who had experienced substance abuse or homelessness. So this was kind of a vulnerable group of adults. And then finally, we had a group of service providers, which included nurses, DNAs, health educators, community service providers. We didn't manage to get any physicians during this demonstration, but we would have liked to. And in our scan participants, we had 6 focus groups, and you can see there the list of those, how we organized those focus groups. They were mostly with patients in the community, and then we did 10 interviews, mostly with clinicians and service providers. What did the topic groups do? Well, first, they got together and they learned a little bit more about diabetes and hypertension. Again, they were brought together because they are experts in their own lives and in their own condition, but of course we felt it was great that they could start out with the facts. We started out with facts about diabetes and hypertension. We started out with demographics of the community and who's affected by diabetes and hypertension. And then we reviewed all of the data from the focus groups and interviews so that they could use their own experiences but also learn from the experiences of their neighbors. What else did they hear that was new that they hadn't thought about before? We talked a lot about that. The next step was to conceptualize. So each group worked on its own with a facilitator, and they were asked to brainstorm all of the determinants that could lead to the health outcome of diet compliance. And then once we had listed all of those potential determinants, we asked them to help create a diagrammatic model that, you know, like a path diagram that showed how all of those led to the outcome. And here's a model from our seniors group. This is what we did together interactively, and you can see we used sticky notes so that we could move things around as we discussed each factor. And one wonderful thing about this model is that this is our seniors group, and almost everything here is driven by age. Age has such a central role in how they viewed the conceptual relationships of how these determinants related to the health outcome, which you probably can't even see all the way on the right-hand side of the model there. And this was our second group, our group of adults, and they had more factors in their model, and their model was actually also expressed a lot about their own circumstances because it had a lot about the environment, had a lot about socioeconomic risk in there. It's a really, really interesting model as well. This is our service providers. They got into every domain. They were really interested in every social determinant, and they had a lot to say. And what we did then was actually try to create a schematic of each of these models, and so they could be directly comparable. So we used the same color schemes and such so that we could compare compare across the models. So this was the seniors model. This is what it looked like in the schematic. This was the adults with limited access, is what the term we used for that group. And this was our service provider model. And again, you can see nuances in the differences. So our service providers have a box there, for example, on capacity, which has a lot to do with the ability of folks to self-manage and that sort of thing, which as service providers, that's the kind of thing they deal with day to day with their patients, right? So that was important to them. The topic groups then, again, after they did the conceptual models and a lot of discussion, we asked them to develop questions, but we didn't just give them a blank piece of paper and say, now, what are your questions? First, we did a training on research questions with them so they could understand what a research question really looks like and what makes a good research question. And we did a facilitated exercise with a list of prompts. So they were asked to come up with questions about causes that led to the outcome, questions that they thought would have a big impact in the field, questions that they thought dealt with issues of patient-centeredness, questions that looked at verification, what do we need to know more about, and new directions. And each group, through this facilitated process, created about 30 questions. So the next thing to do was, we didn't really want 90 questions to disseminate, right? So we had to prioritize those questions and see what rose to the top. And again, it was really a process of discussing. So we didn't just ask them to vote on them. We went through every single question again in another meeting and we discussed, why did you come up with this question? Why is it important? What does it mean to you? And after the discussion, we did ask them to vote and prioritize the questions. So each group independently voted on its own list of questions. And once we had our final list, which was about 9 questions per group that made it to the top, we did a further discussion to discuss patient-centeredness. So questions about, well, if we were to research these questions, what populations would we look at? How would we define patient-centered outcomes? If it was a comparative effectiveness type research question, which we didn't get a lot of those, but if it was, you know, what would we compare? What kind of settings would we do the research in? What would the timeline look like? Here's some of our questions. Now, these are the raw questions, and when I say raw questions, this is kind of how they came out of the mouths of our topic group members, but we're not going to disseminate them as raw questions. We want to make sure they're good research questions, so we are engaging in a process of finalizing these questions. But you can get an idea of what they looked like as they were developed by our groups. So these were our seniors. They had questions about drugs and alcohol, economics like copayment, environment, a lot about gaining knowledge and interacting with your doctor, that sort of thing. Our limited access group asked a whole lot of interesting questions, sleep, SNAP benefits, medication side effects, patient education, a whole bunch of interesting things. And our service providers, again, they were interested in all of the social determinants. So I'm not going to read all of the questions here, but they certainly had a good array of questions. And like I said, we don't want to disseminate the raw questions because we want to make sure that they can be taken up by the research community or funders or advocates. And so we're going through a process with each and every question to do a literature review, to look at the specific concerns that people mentioned. So again, like I said, we discussed all of these questions. So they didn't just create a question, they created a question in the context. So for example, on the sleep question, there were lists of concerns. What happens if you have to work night shift? What happens if, I'm blanking, what were some of the, oh, how does lack of sleep affect something like glycemic control, blood sugar levels, that sort of thing. So there were specific concerns related to each question. There were specific outcomes of interest and that sort of thing. And so we looked at all of those things. We're looking at all of those things in our literature review, and we're kind of summarizing the literature to see where the gaps are. Did the question as it was originally posed, is that a good enough question to disseminate? Does it hit some research gaps, or do we need to fix it up a little bit so it's as relevant as it can be. And again, dissemination is a really important part of this. We've been working collaboratively on dissemination questions since before we started, and we're going to keep working on that. So again, finding out who's interested in this, how it can be presented to them, what venues it should be presented in, what format is the best to present it in. And again, we have a pretty complex evaluation to go along with this. We want to make sure that the approach is feasible. This is sort of a list. I know you can't read it, but it's a list of a lot of our evaluation instruments. We're using instruments with every meeting and exercise that we have, with every encounter we have with stakeholders, just to see, get their feedback throughout the process. Here's some of our instruments, so satisfaction questionnaires during things like training, and looking at things, you know, research team, like group readiness, doing observation logs during every meeting so we can document what happened. And that's about it, so we have plenty of time for questions. There's our contact information. So the observation logs were developed so that every time we have a meeting, let's say we had a topic group meeting, of course we are doing an audio recording of that, and sometimes we're actually doing a video recording as well. But we have trained our research team members to fill out these observation logs so that they can make evaluative statements about what's happening during the meeting. They can talk about whether there was whether the goals were being met, whether the people were sufficiently engaged throughout the process, whether there were impediments to engagement. Again, you know, we could wait months and review all of the audio tapes and videotapes, but having that evaluation happening on site in a systematic way gives us much better access to knowing what happened throughout the process. Yes. So we did have a community-based participatory research team that we worked with for a couple of years, but we had, so some of those folks were invested in staying on for this project, but we did have a lot of turnover as well, so we had to recruit some new people from the community. I didn't mention in the presentation, but everybody who participated in this did get some kind of financial remuneration, so folks on our research team were paid hourly throughout the project for everything that they did. Our topic group members received a stipend so the topic group members met 7 times and they received a total of $250. And our focus group and interview participants received a much smaller stipend, obviously. So there was that financial incentive, but we also made sure that people were participating because they were interested in the topic and they were able to make that commitment over whatever period of time it was we were asking them to commit to. It would have been nice to work with a much more seasoned group throughout this project, but we rolled with it, and we had a little bit of attrition, but mostly because the people who are joining this project join at whatever situation they are at the time, and then maybe they get a job or something like that, and they have to drop out. But we didn't lose that many people. They stayed on. The bigger challenge, if you don't mind my saying, was really communicating throughout the project about what this was about and what they were doing, because it was a really complicated project for people who've never done research before, and we really had to stay on top of making sure that everybody understood what was going on.
So, I'm curious, then, was there any convergence in terms of the questions that different groups asked? Were there any areas?
So in case you didn't hear the question, Salt asked if there was any convergence across the groups in the types of questions that were asked. And if you look at the specific wording, obviously the answer would be no, but if you look at the topics that were asked, yeah, there was a pretty interesting convergence. Environmental factors, communication questions, education questions, they came up pretty much across the groups. They just differed a little bit in the focus.
Can you get me on that a little bit? I was surprised to see whether the concept and all of your
I was surprised that they came up as well. People had different explanations for why they thought it was important in each group, so that was really interesting, and I don't know that I could recall offhand what those explanations were. Sometimes it had to do, if I can recall correctly, sometimes it had to do with things like how weather affects your mood. Sometimes it had to do with things like how weather affects your economic status, so you know whether you're able to go out and get work that day, that sort of thing. So there were a lot of different explanations, but I was really surprised as well that that showed up. And then just to give a little bit more detail on how we brainstormed the factors. First, we had everybody free brainstorm, so they could write down whatever they wanted to write. But some people are more prolific than others, and some would need a little bit of help. And so after they did the free brainstorming, we gave out a list of factors that were organized by domain, and we said, why don't you compare these to what you put down? You can add to your list, you can subtract from your list, you can do whatever you want. And so there were some cues there. So if weather was on that list, and I think people picked up on it as well, I don't know if it came up spontaneously. Yes?
I'm sorry, one more question. A little bit about the composition again of the community members. Were they people living with diabetes or who had family members, interested in topics?
No, that's fine. I just want to go back. I think I have a slide here. So our topic groups, two of them were patient groups, and the one was supposed to be seniors who had comorbid conditions, right? So they had obesity or cardiovascular disease. And the other group was adults with other challenges, and the third group was service providers. So they were specifically chosen to be in these groups. I'm sorry, were you asking about the research team or the...
No, we were just... I wanted to figure out if the folks from the community...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Right, so the primary thing was that they were chosen for their connection to the community and not to the disease. So if they were on the research team, they should be familiar with the community and the challenges faced by their neighbors in the community, and that was our primary interest. Now, they could have personally been patients or caregivers or had a family member with diabetes or hypertension, but we did not ask about that at the time that they were joining. So I'm sure that that was an influencer for some of our new members because they were interested in diabetes and hypertension, but that was not part of the recruitment strategy. So the research team is really, in our project, in this demonstration site, really focused on community knowledge and community expertise.
And how did you
recruit them? Well, generally speaking, when we go out to recruit for projects like this, we work a lot with our community partners. We talk to our community partners. We look for people who are interested in advocating for their community. We look for people who are available and interested in making a commitment, but we do not screen people for their previous experience. We don't screen them for their level of education or anything like that. In order to be hired as hourly workers, they have to pass our university's health human resources system, but that's about it. Yeah, unfortunately, they do look at that.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Let me just repeat it. So I was impressed by your sticky note, the conceptual framework. With this whole bi-directional capacity building that you're dedicated, I was fascinated by the conceptual models of the sticky notes and your dedication to bi-directional capacity building. Moving forward, have you envisioned any particular training that you would do, both with providers and other, perhaps, people with less formal education on perhaps using concept mapping or another method to distill some of these ideas in a different fashion? Just as another methodological piece to...
Well, we haven't thought about how we're going to adapt it for other projects, but we have used it in the past. So actually, part of the impetus for creating this methodology was conceptual modeling we've done with our CBPR team in the past. The first time that we did it, we were doing a health impact assessment, a very rapid health impact assessment. We were asked to do one on the impact of what would be the community impact of reduced SNAP benefits. And as researchers sitting around trying to conceptualize this question, we said, what expertise do we have? Let's go talk to the community. And so Amber was instrumental in that, in bringing together our CBPR team to develop a conceptual model of what would happen in the community if SNAP benefits were reduced. And they developed a really fascinating model that had a lot of determinants in it that were not in the researcher model. And so we were really inspired by that. And we tried it again. We had a pilot project for one of our projects called the Education and Health Initiative, where we're trying to tease out all of the things that link education and health outcomes. And we decided to do this as a pilot project with our CBPR team as well. And we led them through a similar process of conceptual mapping for those linkages, which was a really, really hard thing to do because there are so many things that connect education and health outcomes. It was a really difficult task, but we really thought they did a great job and they stayed involved in the project in terms of talking about the determinants. They made a video with us. There were papers and issue briefs that came out of it. So again, we were inspired that this was a useful way of engaging the community as experts. And so when we developed this method, this was going to be a key component because we wanted to make sure that through this method, we weren't just going out to patients or even clinicians and providers and saying, we want to hear what you think should be a research question. We wanted them to be immersed in the process of thinking about what affects the outcome so that when they developed questions, they could pick and choose along that conceptual pathway from all of these determinants to the outcome, and they could think about it as a complex process. And they could say, well, that outcome's important, but what I really need to know about is what happens between this determinant and this one, this little arrow here. So we really focused on that a lot during our discussions, that the conceptual model shows a lot of different places where you can ask questions. And I also want to open it up to, how much time do we have?
Lots of time. It's 5:51.
Okay.
6:30.
So I want to open it up.
Sorry,
to, oh, we have a few minutes. I want to open it up if you have questions, either for me or for anybody on the panel. All right, then.
I have a question.
Okay, excellent.
As a thread back to both your work, both in focus groups, concept mapping, what are some of your thoughts on training some of the patients in these registries to perhaps co-facilitate or lead the different group level data generation, whether it be a focus group or concept mapping? Do you envision some of these patients becoming more research partners and taking on more leadership roles in generating data moving forward?
I think some ways, certainly, we do. This will be more limited for us because it's a little bit more of the idea generation that we do, but in some cases we have some of our networks, including our patient voices networks, where they are taking on some of the steps of the process. And not so much as far as leading an exercise like mm-hmm. that, but I think it's definitely, and as you go down the road, once we have methods and teachable mm-hmm. methods and feasible methods, then definitely partners mm-hmm. should be included in the implementation of that.
Yeah. Okay. So Mary on our team is considered a research partner, and so she's done a lot for helping to draft our materials and really, oh, can't hear me?
So we have Mary Scott as our patient partner on the team, and she's been really instrumental in helping us draft out our materials and really think about even just the order, as one example, the order of the questions that were prioritized by clinicians when we first drafted them up. The first two were about employment benefit systems. And she said, you know, if this is going to go to 65 years and older, many of them are retired, So if you start with those two, you'll quickly disengage them. They won't complete your survey. And I don't have anything to, you know, say that she was right and our response rate's better, but that's one of those just, yeah, that makes complete sense. So she's been really instrumental in that, and also thinking through the responses that we're hearing. In terms of facilitating focus groups, because we're pulling from a bold registry, you don't have the ability to understand what skills people have and how they might want to get involved. And one of the things more broadly that we think about when we do patient engagement is really understanding what roles people want to play on research teams and what skill sets they might bring. One of the things we look for, so Mary, for example, is an editor for a newspaper, which means she's been instrumental in helping with the writing and, as I said, keeping my writing more concise. Other people that I know that are patient partners have facilitated focus groups, have been part of community volunteer activities, those sorts of things, and they bring that to the table as their professional experience in addition to their patient experience. So I think if somebody wants to be involved in that capacity and has the skill set to do it, it makes complete sense. I do think you have to be cautious of just saying, you know, you're the patient, why don't you co-facilitate this focus group? Because we all know that takes a certain, it takes a certain skill set that some people have and some people don't. So I think it's a fine balance. But to the extent that people want to get involved, I don't think that there's any, you know, delineation just because they're a patient, they can't do many of the things that we do.
Yeah, question.
Yeah, I have, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase the question. So my question is, so I come from actually a community organizing background, and now I'm on the other side of it, I'm in the research piece, and I'm struggling with figuring out how to translate this different power dynamic with colleagues, and I guess I was wondering if you have any suggestions for that, because I feel like sometimes sort of the structure and the values in PCORI are maybe not understood really by researchers who come from a more traditional framework, and so I guess my question is, like, how do you help that culture shift along within the field of research?
Yeah, I mean, so we have a separate project funded by PCORI that's focused on building infrastructure and support, and we've did a number of interviews with people who are funded by PCORI to start to get at, you know, what are the challenges, barriers, facilitators, and, you know, I think the relationship building component is a huge facilitator for that. I mean, if you think about how research teams are formed, a lot of it's water cooler talk, and we run in the same circles, we go to the same meetings, and you get to know each other. And patient partners or community partners don't have that same ability because we may not always be in the same places. So I think setting up better environments for that collaboration and relationship building is really important. For researchers, I think there are people that come from the qualitative space where you recognize the importance that patient input or community input has. It for quantitative, and I don't mean to stereotype quantitative researchers, but people who are used to dealing with big data and those sorts of things, who it's a new dynamic. I think it's just it's experience. It's, you know, being kind of a co-investigator on some of these projects where they can see how that works. They get better buy-in and experience and comfort level and see how it impacts the work that they're doing. So I think that there's a full spectrum of people who have that experience, who have an opportunity to kind of train their colleagues or coach their colleagues on how to do this. So I think it's definitely a culture shift that PCORI's been a great facilitator in changing.
I'd like to pick up on that. And the most successful approach we have is on our campus, we organize a day to brainstorm ideas for PCORI. Everybody would like to do PCORI, right? But we invited the stakeholders, and some of these researchers mentioned have to sit there and listen to the perspectives of the other stakeholders. But they ended up going away with a little bit, hopefully a little bit wider horizon of understanding of, oh, these are also issues I need to consider. These are also out there. So exposure, I think it's exposure that may help that.
And also, PCORI, during our merit review process, we don't call it a peer review, we call it a merit review process. Second, the portion of our portfolio that deals with specifically design and analytics, That has three scientists that review the applications, but ultimately the majority, even of those projects, have an engagement piece. All other projects, the other portion of the methods program, and then all the clinical comparative effectiveness trials at PCORI that we support have an engagement plan, and during the merit review process, their applications are reviewed by two scientists, a patient, and a stakeholder. And our criteria include, in addition to impact and sort of the more similar NIH sort of criteria, is patient-centeredness and engagement. And we spend a lot of time prior to people's applications, prior to submitting them, a lot of clinical trialists, epidemiologists, health service researchers grapple with, well, how do I make this patient-centered? That's so much messier. You know, how am I going to integrate all this work? And then more often than not, during our check-in calls, they're like, oh gosh, this is so rewarding. I would have designed the survey this way, or I would have not included these response options, or we would have designed the intervention in such a way, or recruitment and retention into a trial is being done differently because we have the patient voice throughout. And I'm not trying to it's not easy, and these are 3-year projects, but I do feel there is this shift, and having patients and stakeholders be part of the award decision making is part of that shift.
Yeah, I think just to kind of add on that too, that the evaluation component is so important. So Emily, I like how you have the observation form, because a lot of what we hear is that, well, where's the evidence that this is going to make better research, mm-hmm. right? And that's both the short term, that we have better outcomes, and that the long term, that health is better for all. And so I think it feels good, but there's still that question of where's the hard evidence. And so some of it, as PCOR is maturing, is really having the evidence from the process to say this is what it's doing and these are the specific changes it makes to our research, and sharing that back both to the research team and to the patients to kind of keep people excited and engaged over the course of research is really important. I know PCORI is working on their evaluation framework that I think will be great. And then the UK is doing some really cool stuff. There's a group that they're based out of the University of Warwick, and they have what's called the GRIP checklist. And it's a systematic way of reporting how patients and public are involved in research. And so I think as a community, not only are we talking about what's working within our own circles, but then when we report on the work that we've been doing, that it gets reported in the work that we're doing about here's who was involved, here's how they were involved, here's what difference it made onto our research. So I think it's like turning the Titanic and really getting the word out there as PCOR itself is maturing. So. Mm-hmm.
I just say one thing, which is, anyone have any dissemination ideas? For our research questions, I'd love to hear them, and thank you, Jim. I'm a PCORI site in North Carolina. We're actually having the same issues, trying to figure out how we're missing our results, and some of the things that we're thinking about doing is actually starting, one of them is the newsletter idea of also trying to connect the Facebook users who have that disease more and more. We're trying to figure out a way that we can facilitate some sort of social media campaign around that specific disease that you're working with, but that's one of the things that we watched just in the last month.
Well, thank you all very much. Thank you so much for your presentations, and it's my understanding that all these presentations will be made available. So it's really like you all provided this nice roadmap of where you're at so far, and very systematic, rigorous processes. So, thanks.
Thank you.